The future of race in America will win a freedom not only to be black, but also to discover and appreciate one's own individual humanity. It will include not only our obligation as black Americans to the Africa-descended community that culturally nurtured us, whether others accept us or not, but also our obligation to be true to ourselves. Black self-determination is an empty victory if it is not accompanied by one's individual ability to control one's own fate. America will have to go through race to get beyond race.
Journalist Clarence Page. He's here to talk about his new book, Showing My Color, a collection of impolite essays on race and identity. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial funding for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Journalist Clarence Page says that he's had it with PC. But he's not talking about political correctness so much as what he calls the politeness conspiracy. He argues that the issues of race and race relations in this country are so volatile that we live in a state of collective denial, which offsets our desires to undertake honest and open dialogues. Clarence Page is a member of the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune. He writes a nationally syndicated column and appears regularly on public TV's NewsHour and NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. With an excerpt from his new book, here is Clarence Page.
Race has long had a rude presence in my life. While visiting relatives in Alabama as a child in the 1950s, I first saw water fountains marked white and colored. I vaguely recall being excited. I rushed over to the one marked colored and turned it on, only to find, to my deep disappointment, that the water came out clear, just like the water back home in Ohio. Segregation, my dad said. I'd never heard the word before. My southern-born parents explained that it was something the white folks down home practiced. Some home. Yet unpleasant experiences in the North already had taught me a more genteel, yet no less limiting version. There are places white people don't want colored to go, my elders told me in their soft southern accents, and white people make the rules. We had plenty of segregation like that in the North. We just didn't have the signs, which made it cheaper and easier to deny. We could look out of my schoolhouse window to see a public swimming pool closed to non-whites. We had to go across town to the separate but equal pool for colored. The steel mill that was our town's biggest employer held separate picnics for colored and white employees, which seemed to be just fine with the employees. Everyone had a good time, separately and unequally. I think the colored folks, who today would be called the black community, were just happy to have something to call their own. Don't be showing your color, my parents would admonish me in my youth before we'd go out in public, especially among white folks. The phrase had special meaning in Negro conversations. Imbued with many subtle meanings and nuances, the showing of one's color could be an expression of chastisement or warning, admonishment or adulation, satire or self-hatred, anger or celebration. It could mean acting out or showing anger in a loud and uncivilized way. Sometimes you can still hear black people say in the heat of frustration, "I almost showed my color today," which is a way of saying they almost lost their cool, dropped the mask, or went off. Losing one's cool can be a capital offense by black standards, for it shows weakness in a world in which spiritual rigor is one of the few things we can call our own. Those who keep their cool repress their color. It is cool, in other words, to be colorless. The title of this volume, Showing My Color, emerged from my fuming discontent with the current fashions of racial denial, steadfast repudiations of the difference race continues to make in American life. Old liberals, particularly white liberals who have become new conservatives, charge that racial pride and color consciousness threaten to balkanize American life, as if it ever was a model of unity. Many demand that we get past race, but denials of a cancer, no matter how vigorous they may be, will not make the malignancy go away.
Clarence Page, welcome to the National Humanities Center.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Congratulations on this wonderful book you have written, Showing My Color. One of your reviewers says that the book is a real eye-opener. Whose eyes do you want to open? What do you want people to see?
I want to open everybody's eyes. I try to offer something in this book to offend everybody, and I think I've succeeded. If I've missed anyone, please let me know. I think that we need to be kind of shaken out of our lethargy about race in this country in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Lonnie Guinier said we're a nation in denial about race, and she ought to know, since her nomination to the Justice Department was a casualty of Bill Clinton's hesitancy to really have another televised open discussion of race in the Senate after the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings. And neither Republicans nor Democrats in the Senate were eager to have another replay of that. It divided the country so much, it exposed so many of our tensions around race and, for that matter, gender, that I was quite appalled because, after all, if we can't discuss this in the Senate, what is the Senate for? We are so deep in denial that, and the reasons are for the best of intentions. You know, so many of us who remember the 60s are proud. Black and white and Hispanic, Asian, Native American, we're so proud of how far we've come. After all, this is the age of Oprah and Cosby and Colin Powell and the two Michaels, Jordan and Jackson, right? Yep. Who have the kind of admiration, widespread fandom among white fans that wouldn't have been thinkable back in the 50s.
Nonetheless,
you know?
Nonetheless,
you can hear that nonetheless coming. Yeah. That's right. At the same time, which is the era of O.J. Simpson, of Central Park Wilding, of Susan Smith and South Carolina, and Charles Stewart in Boston. You know, kill your kids and blame a black man. Kill your wife and blame a black man. Mm-hmm. Black people are still stereotyped as more criminal than we really are, as less family-oriented than we really are, as less religious than we really are, as less conservative than we really are. And we black people, at the same time, stereotype white people as more racist than you all really are.
Right.
It goes both ways. And I decided at the time of the L.A. riots that I needed to do a book. There was just too much here to be explored in an 800-word newspaper column. I mean, here I turn on the TV and I'm seeing Reginald Denny beaten to within an inch of his life, and these young black thugs are saying racism made us do it. Then I turn the channel, and there's Charles Murray being interviewed, you know, he of Bell Curve fame,
right,
being interviewed, and he's saying, well, white Americans are looking back and wondering what more is there for us to do.
Well, now, let me stop you for a moment, Clarence. Mm-hmm. You put a lot of issues on the table here. Let's move back in time a little bit to this famous expression, the color line, as the problem of the 20th century.
Yes.
What is your argument? Do you want us to see around it, through it?
W.B. Du Bois said 100 years ago that the color line will be the problem of the 20th century. Recently, your friend and mine, John Hope Franklin, wrote a paper called The Color Line, in which he said, I flatly declare today that it will be the problem of the 21st century, too. And I see no reason to believe that John Hope Franklin is wrong. If anything, we have color lines now. Now, what was your question again?
Well, exactly. What do we do with it? Do we look around it, through it? I mean, how exactly do you want us to come to terms with what we are denying as a people about racial issues?
Well, first of all, we have to get past the fantasy that we're a colorblind society. You know.
I look at you across the table, and I see a black man sitting there, I'm not supposed to see what? I'm not supposed to fantasize about no color at all.
Well, exactly. But people say this. I hear people say all the time, Clarence, I don't think of color when I see you. You know, I'm saying, oh, please, you know.
Give me a break.
Give me a break, because, you know, you're not complimenting me to treat my skin color as if it was just a blemish.
Uh-huh.
The fact is, in the context of America, the America I've grown up in, my color means something. I can remember when I was a kid and we had colored and white water fountains. And I recount in the book the first time I saw a water fountain marked colored. I ran over to it and turned it on and was very disappointed to see the water come out clear like the water up north, you know.
Right.
I was about 7 years old back in the 50s. But that was my first encounter with real legal Jim Crow segregation, where the law came down and said blacks go here, whites go there. And my parents told me, you know, they tried to explain that just the way it is, white folks make the rules. They don't want to be with black folks. And, well, white folks have grown up a lot since then, and so have black folks, but there's still a lot of unfinished business.
Well, now, let me stop you. Let's talk about this ugly word racism. Yes. We have indeed come a long way, comparatively speaking, relatively speaking. But what is it that bugs you? I mean, what are the forms that this insidious notion takes in the 1990s that you want to open our eyes to?
Yeah, well, first of all, I guess I want to get rid of the word racism because it's just so problematic because everybody, I have an essay in the book I call the R word,
right,
because the word itself can cause an argument. If you just mention the word, when Spike Lee said black people can't be racist because
exactly,
they don't have the power to be racist, gossip columnists and commentators across the country unleashed on Spike Lee. But at the same time, a little bit later, he said blacks can be prejudiced but can't be racist.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of those who objected to his statement, when he said racist, they were hearing prejudice, and that he was saying black people can't be prejudiced, and that wasn't what he meant. What he meant was to talk about racism as a system of power. So I don't even want to use the word in that context. I follow Bell Hooks' advice now. I use the term white supremacy. What Spike Lee meant to say was that black people couldn't be white supremacists. And in fact, they can be. That's another question. But blacks can very much assist the system of white supremacy, which is a subject for another conversation. Maybe we'll have that a little later. But black people can also be black supremacists. Louis Farrakhan is a black supremacist.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not kid ourselves. David Duke, a white supremacist, has a seat in the Louisiana legislature and may just get a seat in Congress since that new so-called colorblind decision that a three-judge federal panel made to redistrict Cleo Fields' district in Louisiana. The new district they've carved out has about 15 parishes in it, and 13 out of the 15 voted for David Duke for governor. And Duke himself says, this district is tailor-made for me to send me to Congress. Now, it's possible David Duke could go to Congress as a result of a court decision made in the name of colorblindness.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say, let's not kid ourselves about this being a colorblind society. There's still a system that awards privilege to white skin. The Supreme Court, the current Supreme Court, is helping to enforce that system. And I think that we all need to wake up our eyes as to what the real history of this country is and how it still affects us in the 1990s going into the 21st century.
Clarence, you mentioned some of the heroes and heroines. You talked about the Michaels. You talk
mm-hmm.
about, and then at the other end of the spectrum, depending upon your perspective, we've got O.J. and, you know, these ugly incidents that occur in our society. And you also mentioned history. Where do you look, Clarence Page, for the models for the kind of harmonious society that you want to emerge? I mean, does history teach us anything at all? Is it simply back there and going to haunt us forever? What?
I have to look to the margins of our society to look for models. You know, I look for models of true integration. Not what we have now. I think what we have now is a system of assimilation, and that's
mm-hmm.
different. That's where the majority says to the minority, you be like us. You learn our ways, our customs, our history. Walk and talk and behave like us, and maybe, just maybe, we'll accept you as an equal.
Yeah.
Colin Powell has apparently passed the test. That's supposed to give hope to the rest of us. But it also breeds resentment because people don't like being told that their experience counts for nothing, that their mm-hmm. culture counts for nothing.
It also breeds what you call resegregation. Is that your
Absolutely.
Term?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's not my term, but yeah, it does breed resegregation, certainly, in terms of here in the 90s, we still have so much de facto social segregation as well as de facto real segregation. When I was talking about the margins, I was speaking of the areas of our society that are truly integrated, and I mean areas where we have real cultural sharing. I'm very encouraged by a lot of our young people who I see who take a real genuine interest. White kids care about black culture. Black kids care about Hispanic culture. Hispanic kids care, et cetera, et cetera. I'm seeing a lot of real cultural sharing among young people today that I didn't see in the 50s, and I'm encouraged by that. At the same time, I'm seeing a lot of resegregation. For example, a Harvard study from a couple of years ago of school resegregation finds that American schools are more segregated by race now than they have been since 1967. So we have gone backwards in school segregation. Why? Because school segregation follows housing patterns. and our housing is resegregated. While we have more blacks who moved out to the suburbs, thank you very much, since the 60s, nevertheless, they've gotten resegregated into what I call gilded ghettos,
right.
These new black pockets of black middle class, as whites have moved even farther out.
Now, you talk about housing patterns. After a fashion, you're talking about money. How, Clarence mm-hmm. Page, do we figure out the difference between hardcore sort of economic issues and moral issues? Where do you come down in trying to figure out the balance as we look toward racial harmony mm-hmm. as an ideal in this country? It can't be simply dollars and cents. It has something to do with the human heart.
That's right. And those who want to make it either one or the other are looking for magic bullet solutions. We've spent over 30 years getting to where we are right now. We're not going to undo the harm in 30 seconds or 30 days. But what irks me, you know, I've been engaged recently in a couple of public dialogues with Dinesh D'Souza, who came out with a book called The End of Racism a few months back. His proposition mainly is that racism is not really the problem that's really hurting black people now. It's their own cultural deficits. It's morals, family breakdown, et cetera, et cetera. He's not the first to say that. What he does do more blatantly than most is to completely deny any white culpability. He even goes back and says slavery wasn't that cruel of an institution. I mean, Dinesh's book, this goes out of its way mm-hmm. to strive for white innocence.
Well, let's pause on this for a moment. I remember interviewing a philosopher here at the Humanities Center who said that after all is said and done, doctrines and social policies surrounding terms like affirmative action, after a fashion, they come down to one of two essential views. That is, we're going to look back and we're going to redress the past and take special measures, or we're going to say nuts. We're going to look forward and we're all going to play on an equal playing field. Now, I want you to respond to this. I mean, are we leaving out options here that we ought to pay attention to?
I would look forward if we could play on an equal playing field, but how can you play equally when the playing field is currently unequal? If you just say we're going to look forward and forget about the past,
right.
then you are just solidifying the inequality of the present.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why that statement is so naive and with all due respect. I mean, I used to believe that too, but I have had to do a lot of soul searching inside myself and looking at the country that I love as well as the rest of the world and look at why did race express itself the way it did in America? Then can you begin to talk about the inequalities that exist right now and why so many people resent being told, well, just get over it. Get over the past.
Yeah, right.
You know, just forget about slavery and forget about all of the deficits that have been put into the black community. Forget about how you've been segregated and resegregated and resegregated again. How black America has been in so many ways deliberately underdeveloped. As I mentioned in the book, at the end of the Civil War, black Americans controlled about 3% of the American economy. Today in the 90s, it's still 3% of the American economy.
That ain't progress.
So what's progress? Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. How do we measure progress? And not just for the sake of black folks, but for the sake of all America. You know, I make a strong point about the fact that we're moving into America's first multiracial, multicultural century. As much as you have certain Luddite retrogrades like my friend Pat Buchanan, it is happening. The slowest growing group in the workforce is white males. The fastest growing groups are women and people of color. That's progress, too, by the way. When I was a kid, we were colored people. Now
right.
we are people of color.
Well, we've gone through lots of linguistic permutations,
haven't
we? That's
right. But the reasons for these are that different people have come to prominence and power and want to define themselves and redefine themselves.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to get along? That's the Rodney King question. How are we going to get along? Now, you know, you look at the 92 riots compared to the 65 riots in L.A., 65 was black and white. You know, 92 was multiracial, multicultural.
Chicano.
Exactly.
There were Asian.
And Asian shopkeepers, et cetera. Uh-huh. There were Arab shopkeepers out there, too.
Right.
Got less attention. But that's the new urban America. It is multiracial in ways it hasn't been before.
What does gender have to do with the arguments, the themes, the topics that you advance in Showing My Color? You have, for example, one section of your book that you call a Valentine.
A Valentine to black women.
To black
yes.
women. How about this?
I was going to, at first, you know, well, I asked myself that same question. What does gender have to do with it? And the answer is a lot. And I started at the beginning of my project to work on an essay exploring that, and opened up so many cans of worms. I said, now here's a good second book, you know? And so I shelved it. And then just as I was finishing up the book, I said, it was a big gaping hole. I've got to address this. And looked at, you know, Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill is our classic example of race and gender coming to a head in ways that divided blacks and whites, and I mean the black and white communities in quite different ways. I mean, blacks were divided against blacks over this, and whites against whites in so many ways. But I could go back to the early 1970s when a young woman, Michelle Wallace, came out with her book Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman, which was a look at sexism and misogyny in the black community. So many black folks...
That wasn't a popular thing to say.
Either. Absolutely. So many black folks crucified her for exposing our dirty laundry. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as one of my great mentors in journalism, Vernon Jarrett, an African-American pundit from Chicago, as he used to say about that charge, why take it to somebody else's laundromat? You know, all this don't hang your dirty laundry out in public business is counterproductive, because it's like, you know, it's as if our enemies didn't know what was going on anyway. The fact is, we have a gender divide in the black community that's quite a special one that occurs in oppressed communities, because black women, like white women and other women, are victims of sexism and misogyny. But in the black community, there's this extra silencing mechanism that says, don't hang out our dirty laundry in public. Alice Walker was hit with it. Toni Morrison, other black women writers, feminists and womanists, have been hit with it. And I wanted to make a statement in regard to what I think the black male position ought to be on this.
And namely?
How can we have a community that's going to grow and prosper if we are going to repress our women folk the same way white racism has repressed black folks in general?
Let me open a quick parenthesis, Clarence Page. In your book, you write very poignantly, touchingly about Leonita McLean.
Yes.
You say that here is an instance of survivor's guilt. Mm-hmm. Talk to our listeners for just a moment about that.
Well, that's my first wife, of course, as you know. And this was, of course, the most personal chapter and the most painful for me to write. And again, I debated with myself as whether this ought to be a separate book, but I think it belonged here, because Leonita, like myself at the time, we were pioneers, part of that pioneer generation, the first in many ways, you know, we're the generation of first, because in the 60s, in the early 60s, black folks weren't viewed as even being qualified to work in the major white media. And after an affirmative action program called Urban Riots came along, suddenly we were qualified overnight, right?
Yeah, bingo.
And suddenly the major media were out with nets looking for qualified blacks. A number of us have won awards since then, confirming our qualifications, if you will. Leonita and I both came to work at the Chicago Tribune late 60s for me, early 70s for her, and were part of that pioneer group that had come up from the ghetto, if you will, up through the university and into the corporate workplace, and suddenly was feeling what Leonita called the sense of having a foot in each world. Namely, 1 foot back there in the inner city. She grew up in the Ida B. Wells public housing projects in the south side of Chicago, and was truly a self-made woman with a lot of family moral support. It was so important. And then up through Northwestern University and all, and then became the first black the first black member of the Tribune editorial board and the second woman. And was really making it. She was, her essays were being published in Newsweek and Washington Post.
Well, let me stop you for a moment. I mean, this is a success story only up to a point. Then it takes a very tragic and despairing turn.
Yes.
What is there a lesson there in the sense that looking back upon her suicide and comparing the arc of your life and your career with that? Is that a fair comparison? I mean, what is it that we learn from the divergence between the two of you, and what happened to each of you? What has happened?
I think the most important thing to note, the most important lesson that Leonita leaves behind, is that little salient fact that upward mobility has a price. And that's what transcends race and class here, because America's a land of upward mobility. And when we see people moving up economically and socially, we say, oh, boy, they're making it. That is the ultimate success.
That's a bad assumption.
But,
huh?
But there's a price, you know. Yeah. And I've talked to white male friends of mine who say they identify very much with the Need a Story because they came from a poor or working class background, somewhere out in the bungalow belt of a big city or out in the sticks or something. And they worked their way up, and now they're rubbing shoulders with the country club crowd that normally looks down their noses at people right. who have families like theirs. And that, you know, again, as I said earlier, you know, nobody likes being told that their experience isn't worth anything, you mm-hmm. know. And there's a little bit of class resentment there that wells up, a sense of having a foot in each world. That, you know, do I really belong here?
Fair enough. Footnote to our conversation, Clarence Page. Do you think of yourself as a model? Do you rest comfortably, accept that kind of label, or is that stereotypical thinking all by itself?
I have a big ego, but not big enough to rest comfortably with the notion that I'm a model. But I've been told enough that I am that I've got to accept that role.
Uh-huh.
And let's face it, our black youths, just to name one group, needs some more role models besides Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre. They need to be able to look at middle-class, upwardly mobile African-Americans and say, I want to be like that, that is not something foreign to my world. Unfortunately, one of the great divides since the 60s has been the divide between those of us who are making it and those who are trying to make it.
Clarence Page is the author of Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity, available from HarperCollins. A member of the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune, Clarence Page writes a nationally syndicated column. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary in 1989. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio cassette of this week's show. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Audio cassettes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 816. That's program number 816. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. If you want more information about the National Humanities Center, write to us or call during business hours Eastern Time. Our phone number is 919-549-0661. That's area code 919-549-0661. The National Humanities Center is an independent, privately incorporated institute dedicated to advancing excellence in scholarship, strengthening instruction in American education, and to broadening public understanding of the humanities. Next week on Soundings, Art, Architecture, and Spirituality in the Former Soviet Union. William Brumfield, a professor of Slavic studies at Tulane University, will be here to talk about his new book, Lost Russia, Photographing the Ruins of Russian Architecture. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a weekly cultural affairs radio service of the National Humanities Center.